I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Sunisa Lee won the gold yesterday at the Tokyo Olympics in the women's all-round in gymnastics, keeping alive the streak of five straight all-around Olympic titles for the U.S. gymnastics team. She's the first Hmong American to compete at the Games. And here's what she said about how she dealt with all the pressure.
I was starting to put a little bit too much pressure on myself, knowing that Simone was gone. I feel like people kind of put that pressure on me that I had to come back with a medal. So I try not to think about it, and that's what they told me to do, to just focus on myself and do what I normally do, because that's when I compete the best. When it comes to this pressure, I talk to my teammates and my coach. He helps me through everything. And also, I just talk to myself because I know what I'm capable of, and I knew that I had to hit the best routines of my life to get here. So I just stayed focused, and I just try not to think about winning a medal or anything like that, because either way, I would have been proud of myself for competing here.
Of course, the Simone she was referring to is Simone Biles, considered by many the greatest gymnast ever, who dropped out of team competition. She posted on Instagram that she is struggling with something called the twisties, where a gymnast is so disoriented during their event, they cannot tell up from down. We're halfway through the 2021 Games, and a lot has happened. There have been some exciting competitions, incredible performances, some nail-biting victories and losses, all taking place during the pandemic. And joining us from Tokyo, where it's Friday night at 11 o'clock, are New York Times sports writers Juliet McCurr and John Brand. Juliet, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And joining us by Skype, John Branch, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Nice to be here. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, we want to hear from you during the hour. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Well, Juliet, let's begin with Suni Lee's extraordinary performance yesterday. She has an extraordinary story to go with it, and she talked about some of the pressure that she felt. As you watched her perform, what were your thoughts?
Well, it was quite a moment for U.S. gymnastics and also for Sunisa Lee, who's always been the second best gymnast in the United States. And that's a pretty tough label to have for many years of your training, to be behind the great Simone Biles, who hasn't lost an all-around event since 2013.
Wow.
So she's won an Olympics and every single world championships and national championships since 2013. So with Simone out, Suni Lee had to come in, and she had all the pressure of the United States thrust upon her within about 24 hours between the time where Simone decided to drop out of the all-around and the time where Suni walked on the floor and had to nail every one of her routines to finish first.
And she did. I mean, she looked so strong and so, I mean, I don't know if confident is quite the word, but she just looked so present out there.
It's funny. Yes, she did look pretty confident most of the time, but at one point she was standing on the competition floor right below where I was sitting in the press tribune right before she got onto the balance beam. And you could see her chest rise and fall. And she was taking deep breaths. She had one of her hands on her belly, taking these deep breaths to relax herself. But to me, she looked extremely nervous going on the balance beam. And she had a little bit of a shaky performance there. But in the end, she was able to do exactly what she needed to win under very, very high amount of pressure.
Indeed. And I do want to get to you, John, but she does have one of those, you know, extraordinary stories that we hear from time to time about Olympic athletes. Her family's Hmong. Her dad apparently was, according to you, Juliet, you know, really the kind of mover and shaker in her life when it came to gymnastics. And he's in a wheelchair. He had a serious accident a couple of years ago. Help us understand her family.
Yeah, she came up. She grew up in the Hmong community in St. Paul, Minnesota, which is, I think, the biggest Hmong community in the United States. It's about 80,000 people. Her mom and dad came to the United States from Laos, which they had to flee Laos because their families had fought alongside the Americans in the Vietnam War. So once the war ended, they had to get out of town, obviously. So they had a dangerous crossing of the Mekong River into Thailand, where they were in refugee camps, and then eventually made it to St. Paul, where they had some relatives. Like many immigrants, they go to the United States wherever they have relatives, mm-hmm. and that's where Suni's family set up their house in the community. And her father decided to put her in gymnastics, even though people in the Hmong community said that's not quite what girls should do. Proper Hmong girls should not be in sports. They should learn how to cook and sew and do those kind of things. But he said, you know, I'm going to do it anyway. And he supported her, and her whole family supported her the entire way.
And I was going to say, in the video of them watching her perform and then, of course, get the gold was just quite extraordinary.
Yeah, she said her dad alone has 100 relatives in the area. So
wow.
Not only were his relatives there, but her mom's relatives there and other supporters were there. Some people who were not Hmong were there. You know, there are other people in the community. But boy, she had a lot of people pulling for her, and people all over the country and the world right now who are Hmong are really proud that she's able to stand up and win an Olympic gold medal and talk about their community, which she says sometimes is forgotten and unseen.
Yeah, well, not anymore. John Branch, let me get you in on the conversation. What has it been like to cover these Olympics under the restrictions of the pandemic? I was reading, at least in Tokyo, COVID cases are going up. We know the stands are largely empty. As a sports writer, what has it been like for you?
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. I was here a couple of years ago to do some reporting for the Olympics ahead of time, and I was really excited about this. I really thought it would be a dynamic Olympics. I thought the Japanese people were really behind it. I thought it would be very efficiently run. I really thought it could be one of the best Olympics we've ever had. And now it just feels like a place that is a little bit out of touch with its environment. Mm-hmm. You know, you go into these arenas and the stands are empty. The athletes are competing, and it feels just like a competition without a whole lot of heart and soul. And it really strikes me that the people in the stands and the people that are out in the streets around the Olympics are really what give the Olympics their heart and soul. And you feel bad for these athletes who are competing, and win or lose, they don't have somebody to look up to up in the stands. They don't have a parent to go hug in the hotel lobby. It just feels disconnected, and it's hard to really figure out how it's connecting to the broader world, because you feel like you are in this weird, strange little competitive bubble.
Well, I have to say, because there's 13, you're 13 hours ahead of us. I haven't watched one iota of the Olympics on TV. I try to catch up with it on things like YouTube, John. But there is a kind of disconnect even from, I think, people in this country trying to figure out, when am I going to watch whatever?
Yeah, I mean, I can certainly appreciate that. You know, I'll get up in a few hours to go cover swimming, that swim meet, and most of the medal events are in the mornings here, and that's for television, so you folks can watch it in prime time. The whole thing just feels a little bit twisted, and it does feel like we're kind of on sound stages or something. These beautiful arenas that were built for this that have, in some cases, you know, tens and tens of thousands of seats that were expected to be packed are now just basically stages for these competitions. And without any kind of connection to Tokyo, in a lot of ways, you feel like you could really be anywhere. And that's just really a shame.
Julie, let me go back to you. Anything you want to add to what John said? And then I do want to ask you a couple of questions about Simone Biles.
Yeah, I think I agree with John that I've covered a lot of Olympics. This is my 11th. And then a lot of the joy of the Olympics is having the people in the city or the country come and celebrate. They're celebrating in the streets. People are going out to see the cultural sites. You know, everything's buzzing on the street and in the stadiums, so loud for hours and hours. And in gymnastics, you could hear a pin drop. And for a couple of days there were no fans. And then suddenly the other competitors in gymnastics started showing up to cheer on their compatriots. So eventually we had some fans in the stands there, so it wasn't so sterile. But it reminded me of a practice, and I think a lot of the gymnasts thought it felt a lot like a practice, and some of them probably had subpar performances because they just didn't have the adrenaline going.
Well, let me ask you about when Simone Biles talks about the twisties, which is something that gymnasts know. I described it as this kind of sense of being disoriented when you're, I guess, in mid-event. This has happened with her before and I guess happens to other gymnasts as well, correct?
It does. It's, I wouldn't say it's common, but it's not uncommon. I was talking to actually Suni Salee's coach, who said, you know, it happens. It happens in practice to a lot of gymnasts where you have to have the athlete step back, take a step back, maybe have a couple days off, mm-hmm. and start really from almost square one with the skills that they're doing. They fly, you know, they fly into a pit of foam or something really soft, and then it takes them weeks to build back up to the skill that they were having problems on. He said in his 25 to 30 years in gymnastics, he had never seen anybody struggle with that during a competition, which is saying something.
It is.
I'm not sure what it's saying, but it's for Simone to pull out of the Olympics when she was the star, she was the superstar for both NBC and the Tokyo Games and U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee, for her to make that decision to pull out was really shocking.
Well, and none of us can get inside her head. We only know what she has told us. But do you think, from your perspective and what you know, Juliet, and having talked with her and other gymnasts, is it just the kind of mounting stress and also all the scandals involving gymnastics, certainly in this country?
Well, I talked to her about a week before she left for Tokyo, and we had a discussion just about all the pressure she feels as the greatest gymnast of all time. I mean, she's calling herself the greatest gymnast of all time, so partly it's a self-imposed pressure. But, you know, she has her own gymnastics tour going on afterwards. She has all these sponsorships. She's the face of the games. And I think that the most important part of the picture here is that she was a victim of Larry Nassar, Dr. Larry Nassar, who was the longtime national team doctor for USA Gymnastics, who molested hundreds of girls and women under the guise of medical treatment, including Simone. And for years, for at least a year and a half, there was an investigation, a very lame investigation going on. Nobody told Simone Biles that this was even, this inquiry was going on. So she feels a lot of betrayal when it comes to USA Gymnastics and the US Olympic Committee and everybody who knew what was going, even the FBI, who just before these Olympics began, an Inspector General report came out and said the FBI had major errors in the investigation of the Larry Nassar case. So from her perspective, she's not only dealing with this initial sexual abuse trauma, but the betrayal, which psychologists say can be even worse than the initial pain of the sexual abuse.
No question. Just an absolute horror. Let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about the Olympics taking place in Tokyo. We're about halfway through. We've spent most of the time talking about women's gymnastics, but there's much more to talk about as well. That's Juliet McCure, and she's sports writer for the New York Times. Also with us, John Branch, sports writer for the New York Times. And you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call 1-888-477-9499.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with sports writers John Branch and Juliet McCure. They are in Tokyo, where it is 11 o'clock or 11:20 at night, Friday night. They both write for the New York Times. We've been talking about Simone Biles. Let me just play a short clip at a press conference earlier this week explaining why she withdrew from the team competition.
And it's been really stressful, this Olympic Games. I think just as a whole, not having an audience, there are a lot of different variables going into it. It's been a long week. It's been a long Olympic process. It's been a long year. Put mental health first, because if you don't, then you're not going to enjoy your sport and you're not going to succeed as much as you want to. So it's okay sometimes to even sit out the big competitions to focus on yourself, because it shows how strong of a competitor and person that you really are.
To you, John Branch, you wrote an interesting article, and I'll just quote one of the sentences. It may be no coincidence that issues of mental health are rising to public consciousness in the era of social media. And you wrote about the fact that a lot of these athletes have, have social media accounts and have sponsors and do so many more things besides those moments of competition.
Yeah, I think we underestimate how much free time these athletes have, including once they're here at the Olympics. They might be training for a couple of hours, but they're spending a lot of time alone in their rooms. And if they don't have family and friends here, if they only have one coach and maybe a couple teammates, depending on what sport we're talking about, they're sitting around on their phones, just as a lot of young people do. And if you are a big star, you might be tempted to post things because your sponsors perhaps expect it. So you're posting photos and what your regimen is while you're here. And you're probably reading comments and you're probably seeing what people are saying and people are believing in you, which maybe builds the pressure. Maybe you see comments that maybe they don't believe in you. I'm not sure it's a healthy thing for athletes to be so engaged that way. And I think without a lot of people around to distract them, it's become a bigger and bigger issue.
Let me quote you again. You write, John, in short, the Olympics are built on excess, tangled in geopolitics, rife with corruption and cheating. Each Olympic cycle raises uncomfortable questions about sustainability, environmental damage, and human rights. I mean, those are the biggies. It sounds like you're saying with the Olympics, they're falling down on the job.
There are plenty of people who are very quick to criticize the Olympics, and I think it's a healthy discussion to have whether these Olympics or the Olympics are worth the costs. And those costs are not just the $30 billion that it's estimated to put on these Olympics that Japan is spending to have no fans here, but the costs also include the environmental costs, the costs of in some cases, moving entire parts of the city or people who are maybe don't have the wherewithal. Yeah, they're displaced and they're now being moved. And this all depends on which hosts that we're talking about. But certainly the past few cycles of the Olympics are a sort of a petri dish of bad behaviors, both by the host, but also by the IOC in terms of corruption and the scandals that are involved in just getting the Olympics to certain cities. There are discussions to be had whether or not this setup, the way we have it now, is really worth what is really just an entertainment vehicle for television networks and for the athletes. And certainly nobody wants to discount what this means to the athletes. The question is whether or not the way it's put together is really worth basically a show of these games.
Sure. Juliet, I'd be curious your thoughts about what John was just saying.
Yeah, I think this is a perfect example of the International Olympic Committee taking advantage of a country that, like John said, has spent billions of dollars on putting on these games and now doesn't want the games. There's a lot of people in Japan who don't want even journalists here. COVID rates are going up and costs are extremely high with no fans. And, you know, I've written before a lot about just the Olympics coming into a country or a city and taking advantage of everything, including having them build these huge arenas, spending all this money, and then just leaving the city with all these, you know, with these huge bills. Luckily here in Japan, there are a lot of existing arenas and structures that they're using. But I think that the people of Japan will feel definitely used when everybody packs up and leaves.
Here's a caller who wanted to give a shout out to the U.S. Equestrian Silver Win and says that no one talks about equestrian events. John, I know neither you nor Juliet covering equestrian, and there's a lot to cover there. But are there competitions you think that just need more coverage?
I think they all do. Yeah, this is a tricky thing because, as Juliet knows better than anybody, the attention tends to swarm on a few stars that have been sometimes preordained as the stars of the Olympics. And in the case of Americans, that can be a Simone Biles or a Katie Ledecky. And so the attention vacuum tends to be sucked over their direction. there are 33 sports here. Equestrian is one of those 33. And so, you know, we try to go out of our way a little bit to cover some of them. We're not covering them day by day, but we try to at least sprinkle our coverage with some stories about what the key issues are in some of these. You know, we don't write about fencing very often, but hopefully we will during the Olympics. Equestrian is one of those as well. So we're trying to get to everything as much as we can.
Another Simone Biles question to you. Juliet, is she going to – do we know if she's going to compete in any other events?
We don't, not yet. Although today on Instagram she did say that she, you know, she's still struggling with this mental block of twisting and doing these moves in the air. She still feels like it would be really dangerous. And really the clock is ticking for her to make a decision, because her first event final, which I think is on the vault, is Sunday.
Oh,
she
wow.
has two finals that day, one final on Monday and Tuesday. And she has teammates who are waiting, at least in one event, at least on the vault, waiting to take her spot if she decides to withdraw again. So we should find out, really we should find out by tomorrow what her decision is. But in my opinion, it doesn't look like she's going to move ahead.
John, how hot has it been in Tokyo? I've been reading a lot about it. I mean, it's hot here in Philadelphia, but how bad is it?
It sounds like it's been a lot like Philadelphia.
Okay. Yeah, hot and humid,
you know,
right?
Exactly. Yeah, so it's been in the 90s, and it's crazy humid. It's been cloudier the last couple of days, and so I cover a lot of sports that are outside. I can tell you last week was brutal when the sun was out. You know, laptop was shutting down after about a minute just because it was just about to melt. It's interesting with Tokyo, because Tokyo has notoriously hot and humid summers. And in fact, when the 1964 Olympics came to Tokyo, they were held in October because of the weather. It's certainly hotter now than it was 50 whatever years ago that was. But the Tokyo Olympic Committee did not really push very hard on trying to push these into fall, because they knew the IOC wants these in the summer. And again, that goes back to television, because NBC is the biggest rights partner, and NBC does not want the Olympics during the fall to coincide with football season. So they knew going in these were going to be hot, and they are hot.
Well, and I read about some players getting heat stroke. I think some tennis players that were really pretty sickened, John, by the heat.
Yeah, that is true. And then Novak Djokovic was one of those that went to the International Tennis Federation and said, this is crazy. Can you guys move this out of midday? And they did. I think mostly because they were able to, because that by that point, the field had been winnowed. Mm-hmm. To your point about equestrian a few minutes ago, I mean, there are concerns about the horses here. There are concerns about certain athletes here. There was the potential to have this be very, very dangerous, and it has not come to fruition yet. But, you know, the two summers before this, more than 1,000 people died of heat-related causes during this, like, three-week stretch. In 2018 and 19, I guess it was. And so there were serious concerns about what the heat might do. And, you know, we're halfway through and the weather is still hot. So I think it's still an issue for them to deal with and keep their fingers crossed that there's not some sort of major development with the heat with athletes and or horses.
No question about that. That's John Branch. He's a sports writer for The New York Times. He's covering the Olympics in Tokyo. He has a new book out. It's called Side Country, Tales of Death and Life from the Back Roads of Sports. Juliet McCurr also joining us on Radio Times. She is a sports writer for The New York Times covering the Olympics in Tokyo. Wrote a book a few years back. In fact, she was a guest on Radio Times talking about it, called Cycle of Lies, The Fall of Lance Armstrong. I do want to play just a short clip from surfboarding, but let me just make sure our listeners can join us, and you can do it several different ways. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. If there's some sports you want to talk about, or some events or some athletes, we do want to hear from you. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. This is about 26 seconds. This is Brazil's Italo Ferreira capturing the gold medal in men's surfboarding. And this is NBC analyst and surfer Kelly Slater describing part of this gold medal ride.
Italo Ferreira, his first wave on the new board, a huge frontside reentry. Leans back there. Notice his feet moving on the board, but he'll step back before this turn, right in the pocket, slams it. Nice control there, realizes there's another section, comes off the bottom and hits that, solid on his feet. So much turbulence there. Does really well to ride out of it clean. Excellent surfing from Italo Ferreira.
John, you've been covering surfing. What should we know? I mean, that was obviously, we can't see what he was doing. This is radio. But nonetheless, what's special about this event?
Yeah, that's funny. I had not heard Kelly Slater's analysis. He's pretty good at that. Yeah, so surfing was a fun contest. You know, these Olympics have three new sports that are kind of aimed at outdoorsy younger people, and that's surfing, skateboarding, and sport climbing. And the surfing competition was a lot of fun. It's about 2 hours away from Tokyo on the East Coast. The waves were not supposed to be very big. The waves here are generally more like the East Coast of the U.S., so it might be like surfing off the Jersey Shore. But they had a tropical storm right in the nick of time, which made for some pretty crazy waves and a pretty crazy competition. In fact, they hurried the competition. It was supposed to kind of go into this week. And they said, let's just crank it all out. And they got it done on Tuesday. And it became a lot of fun and spectacular images if people had a chance to catch it.
And Carissa Moore, right? She won for the U.S.?
That's exactly right. Carissa Moore from Hawaii. She's the four-time world champion on the World Surf League Tour, which is the big tour for professional surfers. And she, unlike some others, was able to deal with the pressure. 20 minutes before she went out for her final heat, she was really, really nervous. And I think she was feeling the pressure like a lot of these athletes do. And she called home and said, I'm not sure what to do here. And home said, Carissa, you've done this. You're a four-time world champion. You can handle this. And she went out and did it.
That's so interesting that someone who competes at that high level has those moments of saying, I don't know how to do this thing that I do so well.
Yeah, I think we've learned from this Olympics, as if we didn't know this before, that this is really taxing on athletes. And I think one of the takeaways and one of the legacies from these games will be a broader awareness of what athletes go through and the pressure that they put themselves under, but certainly that we put them under by putting attention on them. And again, going back to social media, the comments that have been directed towards Simone Biles, toward Nyjah Houston, who was disappointed with his results in skateboarding. People who expected to do well and then either didn't or decided to step aside are, you know, now the victims of a lot of people questioning their integrity. This is an interesting, you know, inflection point, I think, in our society, the way we treat athletes.
And Juliet, certainly Simone Biles, I'm thinking of Naomi Osaka and some other athletes have, you know, faced a torrent of abuse when it comes to social media.
Oh, absolutely. And in my conversation with Simone before the Olympics, she was saying that the fans have taken all the joy out of her posting on social media, but she feels like it's part of the job. So she understands that she has to present a happy face on social media or present a slice of her life. But she says that just fans can be so cruel that she has to triple check every caption that she writes on every Instagram post, make sure the picture is perfect, that she's wearing the right thing and people can't say anything bad about it, which of course they will anyway. And so for someone that famous and who's been that successful as an athlete, it blows my mind because they're still, you know, it still hurts when people comment badly about you on the internet. So if those people have trouble with it, can you imagine just everybody else in the world who's on social media? But she's on there every day with her phone, including during the finals with Suni Lee yesterday. Simone was there. You could see her scrolling through Instagram or Twitter. And what John said was a great point, was that a lot of these athletes, they have a lot of downtime. They don't have anything to do. And a lot of them are in the athletes' village, but a lot of them are in different places around the country, including the gymnastics team. They decided to not be a part of the athletes' village this year because they had a COVID scare early on. Well, they had someone test positive who was an alternate for the team when they were in training camp. So they decided not to risk it to be in the athletes' village. And now we're in just in a hotel near the gymnastics venue. So they're sitting in the hallways all day with their phones, playing board games or coloring books and maybe watching movies. But it's a long competition, two weeks.
Doesn't sound like very fun. John, let me go back to you. And even going back to surfing, you had a piece about someone described as a wave whisperer. Who was that? What does a wave whisperer do?
Yeah, his name is Kurt Cordy, and he is a wave or a surf forecaster. He is actually a trained meteorologist, he's trained, has a degree in that. And so he fell into the world of surf forecasting. And so he is the one during surf competitions, including at the Olympics, that everybody turns to and says, hey, we have 8 days to get this competition done. And we have about 4 days worth of competition to do. Which days should we surf? When are the best waves going to hit the shore? Yeah. And he admits that he was a little bit nervous because this place is not well known for big waves. And he realizes he kind of lucked out by having a tropical storm show up and make him look like he's really smart when all the waves came. And he said, I think we should do it on Tuesday.
And he was right. Here's a comment from Jeff. The American public is getting the results of their insistence on winning, turning into the Russians of the 1960s and 70s. Somehow we think we deserve these medals. Russia drove the U.S. to form the Dream Team. Now the Dream Team is getting smoked by other countries. Do either of you want to respond to that? Either you, Juliet, or you, John?
I think there's some truth into that.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think there's some truth there. I think we have expectations, and when we heap those expectations on the athletes, whether it's the Dream Team, whether it's the women's soccer team, people and teams and athletes that we feel like should be winning feel a lot of pressure. And I'm not sure why Americans feel that it's some sort of God-given right that we should win everything. But when we don't, as Americans, it can get a little nasty. And, you know, We all sort of track the medal count. We all know where the United States stands against China or the Russian Olympic Committee or Japan or Australia and everybody else. So there is a competitiveness here at the Olympics that is both part of the fun, but also I think a little bit dangerous in terms of what are we really tracking here?
And nothing wrong with winning silver or bronze. Sometimes it's just like half a second difference between, you know, those three medals. That's John Branch, sports writer for The New York Times. Also with us, Juliet McCurr. She is sports writer for The New York Times. And we are talking about the Olympics. We're about halfway through. A lot has happened. There's a lot to look ahead to. Or look forward to, I should say. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Are you watching or not? You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with our guests about the Olympic Games in Tokyo. Here's a sample of a few of the exciting finishes in swimming so far with the contagious enthusiasm of NBC commentators Dan Hicks and Rodri Gaines calling the races. We're going to start with Bobby Fink in the 800 meter. Katie Ledecky and Erica Sullivan in the 1500 meter, Lydia Jacoby in the 100 meter breaststroke, and Caleb Dressel 100 meter in Olympic record time. Let's give it a listen.
And the American is passing by everybody. Unbelievable. Fink is going to win gold for the United States in the first ever 800 free in the Olympics. Wow. Erica Sullivan is going to follow the greatest female swimmer of all time, Katie Ledecky, to the wall, who will win gold. And here comes 20-year-old Erica Sullivan to pick up the silver.
Jacoby!
Jacoby up there in lane three. Challenging Schoonmaker. We've got 10 meters left. Lydia Jacoby, the 17-year-old from Alaska, is putting on the surge of her career. And Lydia Jacoby is going to win gold for the United States. Dressel is losing some ground. Here comes the Russian above him in lane four. But Dressel is hanging tough as we expected. And Caleb Dressel from the United States is going to win gold up there in lane five.
He did it!
Juliet, do you ever feel this way when you're writing your articles?
Absolutely not. I would have a heart attack. I must say gymnastics has not been as exciting to watch in person because there are fewer people there. But I heard it here at the swimming venue, and John can confirm this, that there are people in the stands. I guess maybe they have more athletes, but they're bringing their, you know, noisemakers and screaming through the events. And I must say that I got goosebumps just listening to the swimming, because that's not how it felt in gymnastics this week.
Yeah. Yeah. John, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, if only we all had jobs where people were so excited with our jobs.
exactly.
Yeah, Juliet's right. The swimming competition, I mean, that arena is mostly empty. There are no fans, of course. But the swim teams have done a nice job of each country basically taking over one section of that venue and making it their own. Socially distancing, but, you know, the Americans are bringing noisemakers. The Australians are just loud with their voices. The Germans are bringing horns, air horns. So it does add at least a tiny bit of flavor to swimming, which is kind of nice.
Well, I think what's interesting, you both write for the New York Times, Juliet and John, and yet you have not seen each other. We have you here on the radio together. How many sports writers, Juliet, are in Tokyo? Do you know?
Well, yeah, right. No, we have all met at the what they call the main press center here in the in Tokyo, where everybody has a home base. So New York Times has a tiny little office there where we get our equipment and our credentials. So we're about 34 people strong here, but not all of them are conventional reporters like John and me. There are a lot of photographers, multimedia people, certainly editors, and it's a huge contingent. But once the games begin, we all fan out to these different events, and I meant to address this to the caller that was talking about the equestrian event. And we would love to, you know, if we have an unexpected afternoon, run off to a venue to cover especially a medal round or an important competition that day. But here in Tokyo, we can't do that because of COVID. We have to put in our assignments, should I say, about a day before asking for access to a venue and wait to see if we get a pass to it. So in Olympics pass, you would just run from venue to venue. People would say, oh, there's a great, as it turns out, you know, these two great weightlifters are in the final in Athens, Greece, and you could run over there from the track and field venue. And here you can't do that. There's really a lack of any spontaneity when it comes to covering things. Mm. And it certainly has taken the joy out of some of it for me.
Are you tested every day or on a regular basis, Juliet?
Yeah, we were tested 1,001 times coming in here, including many times at the airport, every time we took a couple steps and before, of course, we got on the plane. But here we test when we first get to town officially through the Olympic organizing committee. And then we test every 3 or 4 days. It's actually an interesting process where at the main press center or our venues, they have someone sitting there with a bunch of it's a vial that you spit into a certain amount of cc's of your saliva. And then you put this code on it, and you register the code with your an app on your phone, and then you throw it in this big bin of everybody else's saliva. And then if you test positive, I guess they would flag you. But we have to do that every three or four days, and that's mandatory.
John, let me go back to you. One of the other sports that you've been covering is skateboarding. Japan has done very well. Take us to those events.
Yeah, so the skateboarding, there's two disciplines in skateboarding. And so what we've seen so far was the street discipline, which is basically meant to look like a playground. If you see people on skateboards riding around office parks and down stairways and stuff, that's street skateboarding. And Nyjah Houston is the American who is probably the most famous skateboarder not named Tony Hawk in the world. And he was expected to win. He fell down 4 times in a row trying to perform one of his favorite tricks. And so Yuto Horigome, who grew up just a few miles from here in Tokyo, the son of a taxi driver, won gold medal. And he is now one of the national heroes, as people become when they win a gold medal. And then the next day, the women went. And I call them women, but the medal stand was filled with a 13-year-old girl, a 13-year-old girl, and a 16-year-old girl.
Wow.
Two of them were Japanese, and one was from Brazil. And when skateboarding was added to the Olympics, one of the things that the Skateboarding Federation said was, we do not want to have a minimum age on skateboarding because we want this to be a competition with young skateboarders, if they're that good, but also so that when people watch us on TV, the people who are young kids will see themselves in this, not a 20-something-year-old, but if there's a 13-year-old girl and she can become a hero, a model for younger kids, then that's great. And so next week we're going to see the other discipline, which is park, which is more like the swimming pool, if you can think of it that way, for skateboarding. And there is a 12-year-old girl from Japan and a 13-year-old girl from Great Britain who's actually spent most of her time in California, named Sky Brown. If you've not heard of Sky Brown yet,
you will
certainly see a lot of Sky Brown in the next few days.
You know, I hate to say this, and I am, believe me, no, I don't skateboard, but I see a lot of skateboarders in various cities. And maybe I was missing something, John, but I was not impressed. I felt like the kids I see skateboarding in Philadelphia looked better than the ones I was watching. And maybe I was just watching, the wrong events.
Yeah, you know, I think I was kind of wondering about skateboarding here at the Olympics, because especially that street version that we had a few days ago, it's very nuanced. You know, it's, unless you really know the sport, you don't realize how difficult things are. I think the park version, which is a swimming pool where the people are going down the ramp and back up the other side and up the lip and out, I think will be more dynamic for non-skateboarders, because right, it'll look cooler. It'll look more airborne. It'll look more like the half pipe in some ways does in the Winter Olympics.
Right, right. I hear you. Julie, you covered rowing. The Americans did not do so well, but help us understand what happened at that event or those events.
Yeah, the one non-gymnastic sport that I decided to cover is in Tokyo is rowing. I usually do it at every Olympics because the women's and men's eight oared boat, the eights, usually have their final on the day, on an off day for gymnastics. Today wasn't that great of a day for the United States team. I knew that the U.S. women weren't favored to win this year, but they had won the gold medal in the eight, the last three Olympics. And at one point, they had a winning streak of about a decade. So unfortunately, they did not win again today to defend their gold medals, and they finished fourth. And it was a whole new group of women celebrating was Canada, New Zealand, China finished third, and the Chinese have built, I think in 2008, before their Beijing games, I went to their new rowing facility. It was a new sport for them, and they said that eventually they wanted to be champions in rowing, and it looks like this medal might show that all their work and their money that they put into the sport way back then has worked out. But the U.S. came empty-handed out of these Olympics. They haven't done that in 103 years.
Wow.
So U.S. rowing is going to have to do some work.
Wow, 103 years. Again, that's Juliet McCour and John Branch. They are covering the Olympics for the New York Times, obviously joining us on Radio Times to give us some of the highlights. And again, we want to hear from you. Perhaps you are not watching the Olympics, and we're interested in hearing from you as well. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. John, this may be a little bit out of your area of expertise, but there are Russians competing there. But I thought Russia was banned from the Games.
Oh, I can't say that country's name. Yeah, it's the kind of a strange thing. Russia was banned from the Olympics because of its long doping history and investigations of the last few years, especially. And the IOC said, well, you can still participate in the Olympics, but we can't call you Russia. We're going to call you something else. And so they have chosen to be called ROC,
what?
Which stands for Russian Olympic Committee, and they can't wear their Russian warm-up suits and uniforms, but they say ROC on them. And instead of the national anthem being played, they play Tchaikovsky. There's a lot of questions here about whether that was really a strict enough penalty to teach a country lessons about what was very much a state-run doping program. And it's a little bit of a farce, and it's certainly interesting. And I think the lesson for other countries is maybe that's not such a bad penalty to have to pay.
Interesting. Julia, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I've covered doping for a very long time, and it's hard to see the Russians here at the Olympics after what they did at the Sochi Games, which is basically take the urine samples and that were tainted with drugs and replace them with clean ones. I mean, it's the worst It's the most egregious thing I've ever seen in an Olympics, which is they basically changed who the winners were and made the Russians the champions. So if that doesn't, that's pretty bad when it comes to the Olympics. And the International Olympic Committee, I would say, is spineless when it comes to dealing with a country like Russia. It's very powerful in the sports world, and they want to keep it included in the International Olympic Committee, the Olympic movement. So, but it's not a good message for the athletes of the world who are clean, for sure.
Well, you wrote a book about Lance Armstrong, and is there any way to know, Juliet, even as we watch these competitions? I think one of the swimmers raised some questions about whether there was doping going on in the swimming competition. Is there any way to know just how clean these Olympics are, Juliet?
No, not right now. You know, this Olympics has raised a lot of red flags when it has come to the doping tests in the year and a half before the Olympics. Because of COVID, people were not allowed to travel as freely. Maybe there were lockdowns in certain countries, or maybe the watchdogs looking at how the drug testers were going about their business in certain suspicious countries. Maybe they weren't allowed in or weren't allowed to work as closely as they usually do. So I wonder, you know, like the London 2012 games, it seemed all happy when we were there. Right. But a couple of years later, everybody started testing positive. And I think, unfortunately, that's a pattern at the Olympics that I think will continue. And I have this gut feeling that some of the performances that you see here in Tokyo might not hold in a couple years.
Wow. John, I was reading that weightlifting actually may be dropped from future Olympics because of allegations of doping.
Yeah, it's one of the original events at the Olympics going back to the beginning of the modern Olympics in 1896. And it's, you know, it's the classic, or one of the classic Olympic sports. How much can you lift? It's the, you know, simplest idea.
Yeah.
But it has been so filled with all sorts of corruption, but especially doping, that the IOC has basically said, we're pretty much done with you. And there is some question whether weightlifting will continue to be an Olympic sport.
Wow, going forward. So what do you, John Branch, do on your downtime? Are you on your phone scrolling through social media? What do you do?
Yeah, I talk on radio.
right, exactly.
Yeah, there isn't a lot. I mean, it's funny because my friends and family think that perhaps I'm living a life that looks like what they see on TV, which is I must be bouncing around between all these different events every day. And really, because of the logistical hurdles, which are more evident in this Olympics than any other, it's all you can do to get to two events during the day. Something in the first half of the day, write your story, then try to get somewhere else in the evening and write your story. So you don't see a lot. In fact, I've joked that the worst place to know what's going on at the Olympics is actually at the Olympics. I get news from home, people telling me things that have happened, people who have won that I didn't know about yet.
Are you having fun, Juliet?
I think that's relative. I mean, I think that John might be having fun. I see him posting on social media about covering surfing and skateboarding.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a 9-year-old daughter who's a skateboarder. She would kill to be at that event, or kill for at least me to tell her that I was at the event. But I've been in the gymnastics venue for most every day for this first whole week. And as journalists here, we have to stay in a sort of bubble for 14 days where we have to report what venues we'll be at, and we can't take public transportation or go in restaurants or stores, and we have to register our health, you know, our temperature and how we're feeling every day in this app. So we're kind of stuck in not seeing much for 14 days. But let me tell you, John has the best assignment because he gets to go at least to the ocean and be outside and enjoy these sports that are, that in my opinion are pretty cool.
Yeah, pretty cool. Well, I really appreciate both of you staying up so late and joining us on Radio Times. Juliet McCurr, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Marty. I appreciate your time and allowing us to share some of our perspectives here.
No question. And again, she's a sports writer for the New York Times covering the Olympics in Tokyo. John Branch, same to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's a sports writer also for the New York Times. Go to whyy.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.